Well, hello. I am Dr. Murphy, and if you're familiar with me, you've probably listened to my show. If you haven't listened to my show and this is your first one, I'm a clinical psychologist and a retired firefighter. I worked for the city of Bellevue for 12 years and ended up leaving due to an injury. And during the time I was there, I went to school and became a psychologist. So I work primarily and almost exclusively now with firefighters. I hope to impart information that that you find helpful. And I am always available for questions. So you can always contact me, which I realize that I haven't always given information as to how to do that. So if you have any questions about anything that I have talked about, then you can reach me by emailing Beth, B-E-T-H, at integrativemhw.com. And so today, I decided to talk about therapy and like when to seek therapy and what types of problems do you want to take to a therapist? What type of therapist? How do you find a therapist? That sort of thing. I mean, I get these questions to some extent from firefighters, and I think it's been asking more. It's been asked more and more, more of these specific questions. For a long time, firefighters didn't talk about therapy, and the thought of even going to someone to do therapy was just not a thing. So I'm hoping, well, I've seen a change that yes, firefighters are seeking therapy more and more, and I've started to see firefighters seeking therapy before they're really in crisis, where before it was pretty much they were in crisis. So I can see that the stigma around mental health and getting therapy and working with a therapist or psychologist is decreasing, and that is good. So I'm hoping that the information I provide today will maybe help lower that stigma a little bit and then help people find what they're looking for and know that it actually is okay to get help with something like that. So, first question is like, well, when do you seek therapy? So I said that previously, I didn't see firefighters until they were in crisis and they were really struggling. And it's like, yeah, there's a lot I can do at that point. It can take some time, but it's usually at a time where they are at that point where they're, I can't work anymore. And we don't want people to get to that point. So we really want people to seek out a therapist sooner. So when to seek therapy, it really depends on you. So in my opinion, I honestly don't think it's ever too early to work with a therapist. A therapist can be really useful in helping to set up like interventions, prevention. So to like give you some more tools to help work out like little annoyances before they become big problems. So one of the things that I often tell firefighters when they come see me is that therapy is, in a way, it's kind of like when you buy a new car, you take it in for regular service. So, you know, every 10,000 miles, 20,000 miles, you know, whatever your car is, it may have a specific mileage where they say, well, we need you to come in at this time. And this is what is going to be done. And so, you know, that when you go in for the first time, you know, you're going to get all the fluids checked, the oil changed, filters checked, changed if needed. But things that will keep your car running at its best. And so therapy can be like that, is where you come in and you just get kind of a checkup and maybe you get some new resources. Nothing major. So it's just to kind of keep things running smoothly and to make sure that you have what you need in case you like hit a bump in the road. And then with any car, inevitably something wears out or breaks down. And that could be true of a firefighter. You may be cruising along and doing really well, using all your tools, taking care of yourself, checking in once in a while with a therapist. And then you experience something like on the job or maybe at home. I mean, we are inundated with stressors. The job is stressful. Life is stressful. And it's possible to have just a little too much, really depending on like what you've been doing all along. So let's say that you have been carrying too much. It's kind of like that perfect storm where you have a few personal things happen, and it could be like a mix of good things and not so great things. And then something at work happens, and then at work you're also dealing with other people's stress. So it's like you're carrying a lot of stuff. So when that feels like it is just too much to carry, that is like, in my mind, that's the equivalent of the car breaking down and you might need a little bit of work. And so with therapy, that might be, going in to see a specific therapist and do a certain type of therapy work, which I realized that it's like, well, what type of therapist do you want to see and what type of therapy work do you want? And I'm going to address that as well. But let's say you do whatever the work you need to do, which is going to be dependent on what that problem is that you brought in. And so the idea is that you do the work on that issue, that problem, and it gets resolved. And then you go live life again. I have had clients that I've seen for, I think 5 years is the longest, but I don't see them every week for that whole time. We might start out every week, but then it, you know, as they get better and they work through their issues, then we might go to every other week. And then it's like maybe once a month. And then it's like every once in a while where they come back because maybe they have a problem that's different than the one we originally worked on, but it's kind of just a little problem. And we work on that and then they go live life. It really depends on the person, like what that's going to look like. So, I guess it's like, well, I've mentioned problems, I've mentioned therapists, and I've mentioned therapies. And in my mind, I know what all those things are. And so, you know, what are they to you? What does that mean to you? I know one of the things that I've heard a lot is that there can be confusion around types of therapists. And so I'll start with that and then move to the next things. But I'm a clinical psychologist. And so what that means is that I have a doctorate in psychology. And then I took a test, which it's a really long, ugly test is what I call it. Sometimes I think there are tests that are more about like how well you take tests than what's your knowledge. And so a psychologist is a psychologist because they have a doctorate and they took that particular test. And it is the same test across the country. They call it the ECCC. And I'm looking off to the side right at the moment because I'm like, what does that stand for? Because I always forget what it is. It is, I know it's exam. It's like exam of professional psychology, but that doesn't account for all the P's. but it's specific to psychologists. And so if you have a doctorate and you don't take that test, then you can't call yourself a psychologist. And there are actually people who get their doctorate and they might take the exam, the ECCC, but they don't pass. And so then they take the exam to get licensed at like a licensed mental health counselor, or some parts of the country, it's LPC, so licensed professional counselor. Those people are generally master's level, but there are doctoral level counselors who either chose not to take the ECCC or they took it and they didn't pass it and they might have taken it a couple times. And that honestly doesn't mean that they're not knowledgeable. It often means that they just don't take tests well. It's an interesting exam. And I'm sure that all of you have taken an exam where you're like, what was that? That seemed like it was meant to trick you. And sometimes the exams feel like that. So you have the, like I said, so psychologist, that's me. I can do a whole bunch of things. There is a counseling psychologist, and then there's clinical psychologists, and there can be some differences there in like what our study is, but also the types of people we might work with. But it ultimately comes down to, you know, what we choose to pursue after we get our degree. And take our test. And so a lot of times people will start to specialize in something where they'll do continuing education, and then they can offer, then that becomes their niche. And then they will treat specific people with these issues that they've done this continuing education in. The clinical versus counseling, it just means like educationally there might be more like science and research like more severe psychopathology that you would cover like in a clinical program versus a counseling program. But that's not to say that a counseling psychologist couldn't work with more severe issues. It just means that they would have gotten training after they completed their degree and got licensed. So, but it's good to ask. You want to know, like, what are your specialties? What do you work with? What have you had continuing education in? And then the licensing is specific to state. So that's something that is good to know. When we went through COVID, the Psychological Association started looking at, now people are practicing from home. And because people are practicing from home, they're going, oh, I want to move somewhere that's like warmer or something. So then they're essentially practicing cross state lines. And so they needed to address that. And so now there are people that may be licensed in one state, but practice in from another state, or they can practice with individuals, they have clients that are in other states, but they have to have this this other certification that says that they can operate across state lines. So it doesn't necessarily mean they're licensed in that other state. They could be, but they may not be. They may just have this this certificate that allows them to provide telehealth across state lines. And there are specific states that do allow that. So there has to be some reciprocity. So not every state offers that, but there are many. And I'm not quite sure, but I know like Washington State, we can practice via telehealth in a lot of different states. So, but that's something that would be listed. So if that's ever a concern, then you can, just look and see like what, credentials they have after their name. So they may have a whole bunch of things listed after their name, which would indicate that, you know, maybe they are someone that can practice cross state lines, along with other things, because often that's where you can see their specialty. Counselors, like I said, there can be like doctoral level counselors where they chose not to take the ECCC. So they having a doctorate doesn't mean you are a psychologist. So you have to have taken that test. But you can have a doctorate or a master's, and you can have a master's of science, master's of art, in psychology, counseling psychology, marriage or family therapy, social work. So there can be like those kind of specific things where then you can take the test to get the licensed mental health counselor or licensed professional counselor. So it kind of depends on your state, which one is used. If they have taken a marriage or family therapy, then they will have an LMFT, which just means their focus of training was in like the basics of counseling, but focused on marriage and family. And then there are people who have a master's and they are licensed to do like clinical alcohol and drug abuse count. So their focus is on that. And so you might see an LCADAC. So licensed clinical alcohol and drug abuse counselor. And so they would have like a master's in some sort of psychology and then have that specific training in that area. And then there are social workers. So there can be like master's level and also doctoral level social workers. And so they're typically like a licensed, there's like three, I believe. So licensed independent social workers, licensed clinical social workers, and Academy of Certified Social Workers. And they can work in different fields. And I think a lot of people are familiar with social workers, like in a hospital setting. But they can have an independent private practice as well and see people. But again, it's that they have a specific training as part of their education, and then they'll get licensed, and then they will do continuing education to then work in the field that is of greatest interest to them. And so nobody in that list prescribes medication, except there are five states that do allow psychologists. There are prescribing psychologists, and there are five specific states that allow that, and then military. Washington State is one that psychologists have been trying to get prescriptive rights. And so there's a lot of hoops to jump through. And the training involves, having anatomy and physiology as part of like, the doctoral training or undergrad training or something. And then essentially like 2 years of psychopharmacology training. So it's like an equivalent of getting a master's in pharmacology. And then the focus is on psychiatric medications. And that would be the only thing that the psychologist would prescribe. So like a psychologist wouldn't prescribe like an antibiotic, for instance. It's just specific to psychiatric issues. And so for the states that do allow that, my understanding is that they've had really good success, and there haven't been any issues or like malpractice issues and that sort of thing. So, but that's something you could see, but Washington State, you wouldn't see that. And like I said, there's only five states. So if you are seeing a therapist, but there is this recommendation that you take medication, then, a psychiatrist or a psychiatric nurse practitioner are the two main ones that deal with psychological and prescription issues. But often it's hard to find someone like that to handle psychiatric medications. And so a lot of times your primary care doc may end up prescribing. So, there are a lot of people who can prescribe medications. It doesn't mean they should, but it means they can. So, you have your primary care physician, there's, family nurse practitioners, there are physician assistants, there are psychiatric pharmacists, which I haven't had any experience with them, so I don't know if they're in all states. I'm not really familiar with them in Washington State, but that might be something that in other states they can and do prescribe. And then there may be limitations on what can be prescribed. Then there's, naturopaths can prescribe, chiropractors can prescribe. So there are a lot of medical related doctors that can prescribe that wouldn't necessarily be appropriate for prescribing psychiatric medications. So the doctors other than psychiatrists and psychiatric nurse practitioners, other doctors that may prescribe, it is better if they are working in conjunction with a psychologist, more than likely, or closely with a social worker or a mental health counselor. But most often it would be the doctoral level social worker or the psychologist that would work with like a primary care physician when it involves like psychiatric medication. So, because there needs to be some follow-up and observation of the individual taking that psychiatric medication, and the doctoral level for the clinical psychologist or the clinical social worker, they're familiar with the psychiatric medications and side effects, and when it's working and when it isn't, because that's part of our training. And then the other part of the training is like making a diagnosis. So doing assessments. So within psychology, there might be a specialization of neuropsychology, and, that's somebody who specializes in doing assessments that would assess how a person is functioning, how their brain is functioning. And that may be, it might be necessary. Like if you get an injury and you suspect like head trauma, having a workup by a neuropsychologist would be warranted. And it might be where a full neurological workup is necessary if you've had head trauma. And that would involve a neuropsychologist as well as a neurologist, and would involve like the psychological assessments along with having imaging done, like with a CT, CT scan or an MRI. Just to see like, okay, well, what's going on? Do we see any type of injury? Do we see something that is causing whatever symptom made this person seek help? So so it can get pretty, there are a lot of people out there that are practicing some aspect of mental health. And so it helps to like ask the question, like, what is it that you specialize in? And then is that the person you want to see? So it's like, well, like what problem do you have? So the doctoral level are generally the ones that would handle the more severe issues. I can't tell you how many times I have had a firefighter come to me who has been struggling with PTSD, and they've been working with a master's level therapist who was comfortable diagnosing them with anxiety and depression. But when PTSD came up as a possibility, they said, I can't diagnose PTSD. And I honestly I'm not sure why. And I don't know if that was just, if that's been specific to certain mental health practitioners or, I mean, which is, I guess it's good that they recognize their limitation, but I'm like, if you can diagnose depression and anxiety, you should be able to diagnose PTSD as well. But they're basically saying, I feel comfortable working with these other things, but I'm not comfortable working with PTSD. And so then they'll come to me. So that would be something I might see. There are other things like somebody that has bipolar or schizophrenia, they would likely be under the care of a psychiatrist or psychiatric nurse practitioner and a psychologist. I don't work with bipolar or schizophrenia. I have a colleague who has done a lot of work with people with schizophrenia, but that's an example of some severe mental illness that I don't feel I have the expertise in. So, you know, you figure out like what you're interested in and what training you want to continue, because there's a lot of things that you could train in and there's just not enough time. So you have to figure out where your interest lies and what you want to be good at. So my area is working with traumatic stress, PTSD, and ADHD. And then along with that is like depression and anxiety. I see people with PTSD. I see people with ADHD. I see people who maybe I would diagnose with adjustment disorder. And that just means that something happened. They're having a hard time dealing with it. And if that's something that persists, then we might look at, do we change this to depression or anxiety? Or is this something that happened traumatic? And then do they meet that criteria for PTSD? So there's a lot of interplay. So it's really important to find people who are, who specialize in that, who've taken training so that they can kind of tease things out. And in the mix with all that is like alcohol and substance use. So that's something that can often confound any other diagnosis. And so it generally comes down to, did this person have a problem with drinking before they started to have problems with any of these other things? And if the answer was yes, then their diagnosis may primarily be related to alcohol or the substance they're using. If it's no, then it's more likely that it's the something else. It's the depression, it's the PTSD, and that they were self-medicating. So those are questions that, you know, as a psychologist, I have to ask and I have to tease that out. And sometimes it can be difficult, but the person you're seeing, the client, you, the firefighter, you know you better than anybody. And if there's ever any doubt about the information that you're providing, then asking family, asking the spouse, asking the significant other, you know, getting some input from other people, like, have they always been like this? Have they, you know, did they always have a drinking problem, or did that really start after, 20 years on the job? And that's something I've seen people get diagnosed with PTSD, and alcohol has been like their main coping strategy. And there was this slow, insidious increase in their alcohol consumption. And as many of you probably know, alcohol is a depressant. So some of the problems that people may have that fall under PTSD or depression or anxiety can actually be caused by alcohol. But if alcohol came after, then it's not the main problem. It was used as a coping strategy, and it may be contributing to the problem, but it's not the main problem. So it wouldn't be the main diagnosis. So there's a lot that goes into getting an appropriate diagnosis, especially if you are a firefighter and you're struggling with PTSD and you want to file a claim. And for any of the states where PTSD is presumptive, it's important, because if they decide that alcohol was the problem before PTSD was the problem, then they might use that as grounds to not allow the PTSD presumption, which I don't know. It's like I don't agree with that. In the way that it has played out and the way I've seen it play out. So having somebody helping you through all that who knows that can be really powerful. So, and then it's not uncommon in all of this for a psychologist or a therapist to work with a prescribing provider. So they may be involved with therapy, and then a psychiatrist, psychiatric nurse practitioner, primary care physician, family nurse practitioner, anybody who can prescribe. I mean, it's like they may be working hand in hand. So, and that's one of the things that has been shown. There's empirical evidence that has supported the benefit of therapy along with medication. But that can be an issue, because most of the firefighters I work with, they'll go to therapy, but they don't want to take medication. And that's okay. But sometimes medication is needed. And one of the things that I often will say is, you know, if you had a broken leg, you would put a cast on it. So sometimes medication is appropriate. And it's for the short term. And I feel comfortable with that. And in saying that, if they haven't had, you know, a lifetime history of depression or anxiety and such. So oftentimes when a firefighter does seek out therapy and they're struggling, it is the first time they've been to therapy, or it's the first time they've been to individual therapy. I've had a lot of people have gone to marriage or counseling, couples counseling, or marriage therapy, because, as you know, being on the job can be hard for your significant other and for the family. And so there may be therapy in that vein prior to the firefighter individually going to therapy. So it's like hard enough for them to even go. So once they do go, then if you're trying to push them to take a medication, they're not going to do it. But more often than not. And that's okay. So I think that's a big part of therapy or counseling, and that is being able to meet your client where they are. So if they're there and they're willing to engage in therapy, but they're like dead set against medication, then that's where they are, and you work with that. I know the clients I've had, if I thought they would benefit from therapy and medication, and they were not willing to go the medication route, I let it go. I explained to them about, you know, this is something just short term. So maybe a year you may take something. It's like splinting a broken leg. But I don't push it. And then we do the work. And if they continue to struggle, eventually they will come around and they will go, you know what? I think you might be right. And I think I need to add something to this. And at that point, they may ask for, a referral to a psychiatrist or psychiatric nurse practitioner, which often, unfortunately, is difficult to find someone who is available, or available sooner than 3 months. So then they may have a good relationship with their primary care physician. So then, then I would work with the primary care physician. And that can be a very workable, doable relationship. So there's, when you seek therapy, it can be for like anything, and it can be for prevention. It could be for intervention. Just hopefully like sooner than later. But it's like, you don't have to get really bad before you seek out therapy. And I think that that's the biggest thing to take away from that. Therapists can handle any problem. I like it when somebody comes in and they want to learn some new things, where they want to get ahead of things, where they don't want to have to come in because they can't handle anything anymore. And that's always refreshing to me. And I really do like working with those people. I like that aspect of being able to help people be healthier. But I also work with people who have gotten to that point where they don't know what they're going to do next. I've worked with severely suicidal individuals. So people who have a plan, and they're like somewhere around, like they really want to do it, but they might have something that keeps them from doing it. And so it's like, that's something that I might work with also. And not everybody will. People will recognize that could be an issue, but they may not want to work with that. It can be scary. It's scary for the individual. And sometimes it's too much for the therapist or the psychologist. So that's another thing to ask, can they handle that? Can they hold that space for you and help you be safe? So, and that kind of comes down to like, the types of therapy. So there are so many different types of therapy, more than I realized. I actually Googled types of therapy. I mean, I'm really familiar with the ones that I use, but there's like so many more that I honestly didn't know existed. So it's like not every therapy is good for everything. So there are some really specific therapies, and it's like if you're seeing somebody for a specific problem, you want them to be able to be skilled in the therapy that's going to be best for that. So you might hear something about like evidence-based therapies, and evidence-based therapies are the therapies that have been shown over and over and over and over to work for whatever that problem is. And that has actually been kind of a growing number of therapies. Like I said, it's like I work with people with trauma and PTSD, for instance. So I'm trained in cognitive behavioral therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, trauma-focused, mindful cognitive behavioral therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, also dialectical behavioral therapy, EMDR, so eye movement desensitizing reprocessing, cognitive processing therapy, prolonged exposure therapy, and these are all therapies that are evidence-based for treatment of depression, PTSD, and related symptoms. I have experience working with motivational interviewing, which is, and I wouldn't say that that is, that's not my strongest one, but that is a particular type of therapy that would often be used for somebody that has like a substance use problem, and they haven't really recognized the need to get therapy. There are a lot of other types of therapies which I'm familiar with, and I may use some of that. I mean, so like mindfulness, breath work. There's like person-centered therapy. What else? Oh, there's so many. Internal family systems I'm familiar with, but I'm not trained in that. So I wouldn't say I was expert in that, which is a therapy that might be used like in a treatment center that works with firefighters with PTSD and substance use. There's emotion-focused therapy. There's somatic therapy. And on and on and on. So I would suggest, like, if you're curious, you can Google it and just look at all the different ones. But it's like not all therapies are created equal. And there can be therapies on, you know, like if you Google it and you find this list, they may work perfectly well, but they may not have, they may not be called evidence-based therapies because they're not used at the level where they could say like, oh, this works for a significant number of people with this problem. So, EMDR, for instance, was, created and perfected around working with trauma. It is now used for a lot of other issues, and it is really effective, but it may not be considered evidence-based for these other issues, even if it works. So, and that would be true of others. Prolonged exposure therapy was a primary therapy that the Veterans Administration used for soldiers, And it basically desensitizes you to like your experience, your triggers, without really, my guess, it's like it's through repetition. So you're telling the story over and over and over again, and then you're going back into that environment, either virtually or in real life. And they eventually found that it worked for some issues, but not all the issues that soldiers might come back with. So it's very powerful when the primary issue is around avoidance. So the idea is to like get you back into the environment you're avoiding. And you can do that by like desensitizing to that environment. And there's a specific process for doing that. And EMDR is something that will also do something like that, but it does process the traumatic memories. And so that's why it has gained such a, has gained so much support, and it's considered one of the gold standard treatments for PTSD, which means it's been shown, with a large number of people over population, multiple populations, to be effective. So, so asking like, what is my problem and what type of therapy is going to be best for that? So if you're seeking help with PTSD, you want to find someone who specializes in the treatment of PTSD, and they more than likely will be trained in EMDR. They may not be, but more than not, they will be. But they will be trained in some of the other modalities that are considered evidence-based for the treatment of PTSD. So, so that's going to be something that you're going to look for also. Let's see. So it's probably more I could say about that, but I think that that's probably good. So let's say, I guess like one of the things, I'm not quite sure which one would be better to address first, but since it's, I have it up in front of me, it's like, what makes good therapy? Like what components do you want present? I think, and I'm not sure what the most important thing is in all this, but I think from my perspective, like what I want for my clients is I want to empower them. I don't want them to get better because of me. So it's like I've had people say, "Oh, thank you so much. I couldn't have done this without you." And it's like, I always say thank you, but it's like, you know, you do the work. I'm a guide, and there may be, depending on a person's, the therapist's modalities that they use, they may have different ideas about like what they bring to therapy and who has what responsibility, but I work collaboratively. I am an expert on psychology. You're an expert on you. That's what that means. So I will listen to you, and I will challenge you when I believe that what I'm hearing needs to be challenged. And then I will suggest things. Not everything works for everybody. So I might say, you know, here's a number of tools that can be useful. So try them out. Let me know what works for you. And so there's this back and forth in this, you know, you do something and then you give me feedback and then we adjust things based on how it works for you. And then I want to empower you. I want you to walk away from therapy and not feel like you have to be in therapy your whole life. My job is to help you get through what you're struggling with and hopefully never have to see you again. And not that you're not a nice person and I didn't enjoy interacting with you, but it's like, as far as like being your psychologist, it's like, I want you to be better. I don't want to have you for a lifetime. And then, you know, maybe you'll get better. And then a few years down the road, we run into each other and then we can be friends. Who knows? But while we're working together, then I'm the psychologist and you're the client. But the other thing is, like, I try really hard to be non-pathologizing. And that means I don't want you to feel bad about whatever struggle you're having. A big part of the struggle, particularly what I've heard a lot from firefighters, there's a huge shame piece with that struggle. Whether there's alcohol and or substance use involved with that, but it's like that shame comes from thinking like there's something wrong, you know, like there's something wrong with me. I'm wrong. Not that I did something wrong. It's like that I am wrong. And that's where that, or I'm not good enough or something. It's like that little voice that just nags at you. And firefighters who struggle with PTSD, they have some, there's some shame associated with it. And it is possible to inadvertently like kind of feed that, and that comes from that, like, what I was going to say, over pathologizing, but it sometimes is difficult to non pathologize. And that's been something that I've worked a lot on, because the biggest question that I get is like, why am I struggling? And the person next to me isn't. And it's like, well, on the outside, that may be a true observation, but it's like everybody struggles with stress. So, you know, I had to do some more training and educating myself in neuroscience so that I could find a way to talk to the firefighters to help them understand why they might be struggling when the person next to them doesn't seem like they're struggling. And it really comes down to everybody has a stress reaction. There's no way around it. It's just like, what do you do about it? And, you know, did anybody ever teach you what to do about it? Did anybody ever teach you you had a choice about what to do about it? And what I find is a lot of the things that are preventative are not that complicated, but they are things that people aren't taught, especially men. And the fire service doesn't really, well, it doesn't train you in those things. It doesn't say that these things are okay to do, or that it's okay to feel this way because it's your stress response. So that non-pathologizing, it's like you are not your problem. It is something that you struggle with, and everybody at one time or another may struggle with that. So, you know, that's what we want. That's what I want people to take away. The relationship is really important. A therapeutic relationship is like one of the closest relationships that a person can ever have. And so that is something that I really value. And there are times where I might do something because of like my own stuff that inadvertently hurts my client. And then that can hurt that relationship. And so when there is that rupture in the relationship, because we're all human and sometimes things happen, being able to repair that can be really powerful. And not everybody is at a place where they can tolerate that. So they may have something happen and then not give that therapist a chance or the psychologist a chance to repair that relationship. Most often, if they do, the relationship ends up being even stronger. But it really comes down to, you know, you have to trust where you're at and who you're with. And so I really don't like when I do something that hurts my client. It's never my intention. And so when that happens, I always hope that they will talk to me about it. Cause sometimes I may not know that I did or said something that hurt them. And I want them to talk to me about it. I want to have a chance to make things right. If it's something that happens over and over again, it might be that you're not a good fit. And that's the other important thing is like when you're trying to find somebody to work with, you may work with someone that a friend recommended and they had a great experience and they highly recommend this person. But then when you start to see that person, your experience is different and it doesn't quite fit and it doesn't quite feel good. So it's okay to go, you know, this just doesn't feel like a good fit. So I think I need to find someone else. And you can do that. Not every therapist is a good fit for everybody. There are people who I know would not be a good fit for me. And I've had a couple people say that. And, you know, it's like, yes, it might hurt a little bit because I do have an ego like anybody. But I can understand. I'm not for everybody. And that is okay. And then I think the other thing is like to not to expect perfection. I actually had a client that I think that's really what they wanted. And I am not perfect. I am human. I am imperfect. and so good therapy is imperfect. And it's like in that imperfection that you kind of work those processes and you can work things out. So it's like, don't expect your therapist to be perfect because, they're not. And expecting that can set you up for not the best experience. And then there's focus. You want your therapist to be focused on you, on your problem. And so there are times where you might be working with somebody, but they seem like they're more interested in everything else. And that might be an indication that person isn't right for you. And it may be an indication that therapist is going through something. So again, it's like their therapists are people, they're human. And so they may have a struggle that they have yet to recognize, just like firefighters. So, and there may be some other aspects in there that may be important for you, but I think that It's important for you to know, you know, like when you decide to go, like what is the problem that you're going to bring? And I will tell you a lot of times the problem that a person takes into therapy is not really the problem. It's something a little bit deeper. And so therapy often gets at that. But if it's that, that's fine. You know, it's like you start with that, you know, meet the client where they are, work on that problem, help find the solutions. So it's like you bring in what you want to bring in and you're going to work on what you want to work on, regardless of what the therapist, counselor, or psychologist thinks the problem is. And so they should be listening to what you're bringing in and working with you on that, and then explore the possibility that there's something more and not try and push that on you. So then, you know, the type of therapy, that's going to depend on what you bring in. And you may need to find the therapist and discuss with them what the problem is and do they provide the therapy that is going to be the best fit for that. And so that's, you know, there's some things that just kind of go hand in hand. And then I guess the last thing, which might be the most, it might be the most important thing, is how do you find a therapist? That can be hard and it can take some persistence. Most therapists are individual solo practitioners. They may or may not have an answering service. They may not be that great at getting back to people quickly. I know that I get so many calls and emails for potential clients that it can be overwhelming because it's just me. So I am actually looking for somebody to help me so that I can get back to people, or my assistant can get back to people and let them know whether I can take them or not. But you may make calls and find that they don't call you back. I've heard that so many times. It's like, I've called six people and nobody called me back, or you're the first person to call me back. And I might've called them back like a week after they called, but they hadn't heard from anybody in the meantime. Being persistent is something, unfortunately, you have to be. There are, unfortunately, a high need for therapists, and they take on people and they get full, because there is a limit, because we can get burned out too. So it's just know, first and foremost, you need to be persistent. So how do you find someone? I think getting a referral from somebody you know and trust is probably the best way. So if you have a friend that sees somebody, maybe you can go see that person, or maybe that person knows a person or has a colleague that they think would be a good fit. So that word of mouth can be, I think that that's one of the first things that I would say that I would trust is word of mouth. The second is if you have a good relationship with your primary care doctor or your specialist. I mean, it's like they may be a good person to ask, and they may know someone or they may know a couple people. So those referrals from trusted people, whether it's a friend or another caregiver. So those would be, that would be like number one. Number two might be from like your insurance itself. So you can go online to your insurance provider and look up who they have in your area. Which you may find that there are a lot of people in your area. And just because there's a lot listed doesn't mean that they're available or that they're even currently practicing. And that can be a problem. So once you do that, once you find people in your area from the list that you can get online from your insurance carrier or if you've called, they may give you a list. Once you have that list, then go online and Google them. And look and see if they have a presence. Do they have a website? Do they have reviews? Because sometimes reviews come up when you Google people. And I will say reviews, take them with a grain of salt. Don't ignore them, but take them with a grain of salt. Because it may be just somebody who is, you know, disgruntled and their complaint may not be really relevant to how they actually practiced. But just take it with a grain of salt and ask questions for yourself, I would say. But look for their presence online, and when you see their website, how does that feel to you? Do you feel like, oh, that is so comforting? I need to call this person or email this person, or is it really busy and disjointed? And chances are their website is going to reflect their personality a little bit. That's not always the case, but it often is. So I often will go with like a gut feel when I'm trying to find somebody. So, but that list can be invaluable. The other is to look up, like Psychology Today. You can go to psychologytoday.com and then you can find someone based on the parameters you need, like the insurance you take, the issue that you want to work with, male or female, their location, their type of therapy they specialize in. I mean, so you can really dial it in to find someone, and then find someone that way. And then, if you know that you are struggling with PTSD, or you're pretty sure you are, and you've read about EMDR and you're like, oh, I want to do EMDR, I really want to try it, then go to emdria.org. It's EMDRIA.org. And they have a list of therapists that are trained in EMDR. So you can sometimes go to the certain modality that you're like, I'm sure this is going to work for me. And they will have a website that you can see who's been trained in it and who's practicing in your area. The American Psychological Association, they also have a listing. So you can find somebody by going to their website. So APA.org. And then you can find a psychologist. And then you can, again, like narrow that down. The Washington State Psychological Association or your particular state, will have an association and you could search. They will have a psychological association. And then there's also the American Counseling Association, and then your state would have an equivalent also. And so that will list people at the psychologist or the, the counselor level. And then there's also like your work EAP, your peer support. And then there are a number of organizations that are specific to firefighters that you can go to and look up if they have a list of therapists. And I know there are many that do. At one time, I could have rattled off several for you, but you probably could go to the IAFF site, and then there are probably are links there. I think Lexapol, if you look on their site, I don't know why I'm blank, the National Volunteer Organization, I know that they have a list, there are several. So I'm sure that your organization that you may be aware of, like whatever, if there is a certain like an app that that your organization has gotten for you, usually during that app, I think like First Responder Wellness is one, and there's a number of other ones. So it's like you just kind of are going to start where you want to, and so basically starting closer to home and more trusted. And then you start working your way out. And ultimately that means like you just start Googling people in your area, like PTSD therapist in whatever state, whatever city you're in. That would probably be the most impersonal way. So there are a multitude of ways, but look, make your list and then call, email, and be persistent, and try and be patient. It's unfortunate that so many people need help, but a lot of the therapists and psychologists are busy and they have a lot of clients. So be persistent. And if you need help, you can ask your partner to maybe call on your behalf, or maybe somebody that's involved with peer support, you could ask them to call on your behalf. And sometimes the insurance companies will have somebody that will call on your behalf. And I'm not sure under what circumstances they do, but I know that I've gotten calls from an insurance representative that said that they were looking for therapy on behalf of their member. So it's like, just be persistent, make your list, go with your gut, try and match up your issue with somebody who specializes in it. And then cultural competence, I didn't really talk about that. But if they work with first responders, that's great, because that's one less thing that you have to explain to them. But somebody that says they specialize in working with first responders may have some assumptions that are inaccurate regarding what your job is, and you may find that you will have to correct that. But it's, you know, be open. If you can't find somebody with that cultural competence, look for somebody with expertise in the problem. So a marriage and family counselor is not necessarily going to be the person you want to talk to for PTSD. So that's it. Hopefully that helps. And it made sense to you. And you can always contact me if you have questions. But I think that, that gives you enough that you should be able to find somebody to talk to, and sooner than later, you don't have to be bad to get help. Starting early before you're in crisis is the best approach to take. So thank you very much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this content.